Baruch Habayim, welcome everybody. This evening we begin tape number 24. And this evening we're going to talk about a topic that's related primarily to parents of very rebellious teenagers or anybody that comes in contact with very rebellious teenagers and decides that they'd like to be a positive influence on their lives. And we're going to discuss, and I don't mean to be facetious about it at all because this really is serious, how to keep your sanity while dealing with rebellious teenagers. And the reason I feel that this is a topic that needs to be discussed is because I've seen too many people, including one of my staff members, unfortunately, who have literally been driven over the edge. Over the edge. Because of their involvement. Their deep involvement, their sincere involvement, and their serious involvement with rebellious teenagers. There was a member of my staff who once upon a time was a very nice, normal person. After a while, and this is not a fiction story, this is a very sad story. He came with very good recommendations, and although he wasn't the brightest person in the world, he made up an effort for what he lacked in talent, and he spent hours and hours really trying to help kids, and he even did some very good work and accomplished some very good things. After a while, though, bizarre things started happening. Personality started changing. He started talking closer to the rebellious teenager way of talk than he used to. He started thinking and behaving in inappropriate ways that don't necessarily bear explaining now. After a while, it got worse. See, we, in our business, we deal, unfortunately, with very desperate people. Parents are desperate because the lives of their children are at stake. The children are desperate because they know deep down, and sometimes even more on a surface level than that, that their lives are at stake. Desperate people. And for somebody with an unscrupulous side to him, these people can be taken advantage of because they're vulnerable. And such types of indiscretions were being committed by this formerly very honorable person. In short, what was happening was, instead of him being makarev the kids were being makarev him. Parents were complaining. Kids were complaining. Rumors were being spread by him. Revenge was being taken by him on children that didn't respond to him. It was a terrible, terrible sight to behold, and although it was quite obvious to me what needed to be done, nevertheless, on the advice of Hagoyin Rav Shimon Schwab, Zechet Tzadik Lebracha, I got rid of this worker, and as Rav Schwab told me, not only for the kid's sake, but for his sake as well. Because not everybody is cut out for this type of work. If you're a lifeguard, you have to make sure you know how to swim very well before you try to save a drowning person. And if the person is drowning in a sewer, then you really better make sure that your swimming skills and your bar of soap are in working order. And although this is the case that closest to me, There are numerous other instances of Erlich Yidden, of sincere Jews, that went into various different types of Kiruv and found themselves being Mikurov to and by those that they should be influencing. And question, therefore, arises, how do you, as somebody who wants to influence others, or somebody, specifically we're talking about somebody who has no choice in the matter, a brother, a sister, a parent, somebody, how do you make sure that you remain steadfast in what you are doing, even though you are seriously involved with a bad influence? Now, you in the audience may think that, this has nothing to do with me, it's only the other guy that this happens to. Don't forget, we're running around telling our children that they should stay away from the bad influences, and they're giving us the same line. No, mommy, no, Tati, it doesn't happen to me. I'm strong in my commitment. It happens to the other guy. And we tell them, no, Tatala, no, Mamala. That's not the way it works. How do we put our money where our mouth is, therefore? How do we run a Torah home and remain a pure, holy Torah personality, and at the same time be able to relate as a friend, as a helper, as a companion to somebody who would be considered a terrible, terrible influence? I just recently read an article in the Jewish Observer where a study was written about, a study where there was one man sitting in a class, and I think there were 20 others. The one man was the person who the experiment was done on, and unknown to him, the other men in the class were plants. What happened was they drew two lines on a blackboard. One was 10 inches long and one was 12 inches long. And the teacher asked the class which one of these lines was longer. Of course, there was no ruler with which to gauge them. The people who were planted in the class all said that the 10-inch line is longer. 60% of the time, the objective student in the class would go along with the rest of his peers and say that the 10-inch line was longer, even though his eyes told him differently. Another 30% would give in upon prodding. They would first say, no, what are you talking about? That line's bigger. And then everybody would argue with him, and at the end he would give in. 9 out of 10 times, by peer pressure, you can convince somebody what their eyes see and what their mind knows is not so. Now, before we discuss how to protect yourselves, we first must preface our remarks with a short halachic analysis of whether or not you are permitted to put yourself in a situation of helping someone else knowing they will be a bad influence. This is one of the nuclei of the Kiruv industry. That fact notwithstanding, there is a open chazal in Avos de Rebbe Nosson, which reads as follows: Al tischaber la rosho, afilu lekarvoy l'tayra. Do not befriend rosho, even in order to be makar of him to Torah. That's the words of the chazal. Now the question is twofold. Firstly, what does it mean to befriend somebody? What are the parameters of how close we are allowed to be? And two, what does it mean, Russia, over here? In a common and usual Kiruv situation, the person we're dealing with is what we call Tinoik Shenishba, which means that they're not wicked or evil because they didn't voluntarily throw off the yoke of Torah and mitzvahs, but they weren't brought up with it. And that may disqualify them for the title Russia. Well, I'll tell you. I had brought this Shaila, had asked the advice of a number of Gedolei Torah in Eretz Yisrael, and I got a number of different responses. Rabbi Yisrael Yanke Fisher, Olzayin Gesund, told me that when it says Al Tischave El Rosha Afilu LeKarvoy LeTaira, it does not apply to a Tinoik Shenishba. It does not apply to somebody who was not brought up with Torah, although it would apply to somebody who threw off the yoke of Torah himself. I'll tell you, I came into Rabbi Yisrael Yanke Fisher's study armed with a Mishnah Brura and a Minchas Elazar, which to me suggested differently. The Mishnah Brura, in the laws of Erevin, states that a halacha of Bittul Erevin, Bittul Rishuyos, applies to a Tinoik Shenishba, even though you don't consider him like a non-Jew, but since the Gezeira was that we should, that the non-Jew is Mevatel the Rishus, because we did not want Jews living in the same proximity as non-Jews, therefore, if somebody is not from, it makes no difference in this instance whether they are not from because it's their fault or it's not their fault. As long as they're not from, they can be a bad influence. And where bad influence is concerned, even a Tinoik Shenishba needs to be, you need to stay away from. Zainish disagrees there, but that's the Mishnah Brura's opinion. The Minchas Elazar says a similar thing regarding Bishul Akum, Ayin Nesach. I presented this to Rabbi Yisrael Yanke Fisher. He said it doesn't matter. He didn't accept what I had to say. He said, not so, it doesn't apply to a Tinoik Shenishba. Rav Shmuel Wozner disagreed totally. Rav Wozner held 100% that it applies also to a Tinoik Shenishba, Al Tischave El Rosha, Afilu LeKarvoy LeTaira, because of the reasons that I had submitted. I asked two more Gedolim, and I got two more answers. Aval Yashiv and Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach Zeichet Tzadik Lebracha. Reb Shlomo Zalman told me that Jews in America are not considered Tinoikos Shenishbu. Jews in America, the public school kids that grow up in, I don't know, in the Bronx, they're not considered innocent to the point where we classify them as Tinoik Shenishba. He said, if you tell somebody you're Jewish and you have an opportunity to be frum, and if you do, the government will not bother you about it, and they know that, you already no longer classified as Tinoik Shenishba. And therefore, regarding all Kiruv, you have to avoid what's called Hischabrus. I'll explain in a moment what that means. Aval Yashiv gave me a fourth opinion. Told me that the statement Al Tischave El Rosha Afilu LeKarvoy LeTaira is not meant because we are afraid that you will be influenced by the person who you are trying to be Makarev, but rather that if he's a Rosha, all your Kiruv attempts will not work. So there's no reason to befriend yourself to him. And since we see that a Tinoik Shenishba does respond or may respond to Kiruv attempts, therefore, you are allowed to befriend a Tinoik Shenishba. Four Gedolim, four opinions. According to Reb Shlomo Zalman, the prohibition to befriend such a person means not that you're not allowed to deal with him, you are allowed to deal with him. You are allowed to invite him to your home for Shabbos. You are allowed to talk to him. But the mashal he gave, you can't go with him to a ball game, because that's his chavrus. And aside from Rav Yashiv's interpretation of the statement of Chazal, there are many people, most people disagree, and they claim that Al Tischaver LaRosha Afilu LaKarvay LaTorah is because we are afraid that you will be influenced. Most Mefarshim explain it that way. We have a dilemma now. We have a very, very big dilemma. If you are forced into a situation where you must deal with a rebellious teenager, how do you do it and at the same time remain free of the influence? Incidentally, regarding the classification of people as Rosho, Tinek Shenishba is not necessarily the only way to remove someone from the category of evil. There is a Tosfos in Masechet Shabbos which states that there is a difference between somebody who brazenly throws off the yoke of Torah as opposed to somebody who threw off the yoke of Torah under great stress because of a great nisoyon, because of difficult temptation. Even though the person that threw off the yoke of Torah, somebody that did an Aveira, because of great temptation, although he's not considered an Oines, he's not considered as if it was done against his will, although he's responsible for it according to the Torah, nevertheless, it's not the same as somebody, halachically, it's not the same as somebody who just brazenly threw off the yoke of Torah. And regarding certain halachas, we grant a person help even if he is considered a mazid, even if he's not potzer, even if he's not exempt from his act. I can't this evening go into the issue of how close to get to rebellious teenagers and how thick of a wall you have to plant between yourself and them. That's a topic for a different evening. This evening, the discussion is about how to remain free of the influence if you find yourself in a situation where you end up dealing with them. Even within the parameters of outside of what's called hischabrus. That's why I tell you that I know of a number of people, good people, that fell very, very hard because they didn't know how to do this. We discussed previously about how to harbor a rebellious teenager in your own home. Harboring means how to live with his antics and at the same time maintain a Torah Dikah home. The first thing that you have to do in order to protect yourself from the hazards of having a bad influence in the vicinity is, first of all, you have to have a talk with the other siblings. The other siblings have to understand what's happening. If they don't, then they will come to you and they will say, well, how come Ruchi is allowed to dress like that and I can't? I'll say, Ruchi is a rebellious teenager and you can't force her to dress the way you would like. And therefore, you look away. How come she's allowed to dress that way and I can't? There's an influence already. It's the first place that seeps in usually, creeps in. Your other children will come to you saying, why is Aaron allowed to go there, and I'm not. Why is he allowed to come home late at night, and I have a much earlier curfew? It's best to deal with this before it happens. If there is a problem child in the home, the parents should sit down individually with the other children and explain to them that Rachel or Aaron are in need of assistance. They're in need of assistance by the entire family. And just like, and this is a mushal, not a dimyan, it is an analogy, not a comparison. We don't want to insult or belittle the needy teenager. Somebody who's physically ill needs special medicine. They get to stay home from school, get to wake up late. They have different guidelines. So too, and again, this is an analogy, not a comparison. So too, somebody who is in need of emotional assistance and Frumkeit assistance has to be treated differently. This will solve two problems. It will solve the perception of imbalance and unfairness on the part of the siblings, and it will prevent potential disaster in the form of the siblings berating, belittling, and putting down the problem teenager. Very often, very, very often, in families of B'nai Torah, where there's a problem child, what's going to happen is that the brothers and sisters, the parents will be cooperative, but an older brother or an older sister will make derogatory remarks directed at the problem teenager. It's poison. Teenagers will gravitate to where they feel more important. The basic rule of teenage nature. We want them to feel important among B'nai Torah, because they already feel important in the street. Today I was talking to a father, a big Talmud Chacham, has a son, a real yeshiva bacher. Ept. It's a problem. During the day, he's a mild-mannered yeshiva bacher who learns very, very well, but at night, takes off his glasses and his suit, he puts on his t-shirt and his jeans, and it's La'Yehudim. Youngest in the family. And incidentally, from the few hundred teenagers that I've dealt with, the greatest percentage problems, there's a disproportionate percentage of problems that come from the youngest in the family. Especially, particularly, if the difference between the youngest and second youngest is more than just a year or so. There is a great gap between the youngest in the family and the next youngest in the family. That's even a disproportionately greater amount. But in any case, I was talking to this father, and he was telling me how in yeshiva they look at this boy like an oisvarf. They look at him askance. They look at him like a lolif. One of the older bachurim in the yeshiva told him, "You better not marry a shiksa." What does this boy do? He talks to girls, went to a movie. When I say that singular, he goes to movies, he went to a movie. And one evening this boy did not come back. He told his father, "I'm out of here, goodbye." He only stayed away for a few days. A few days is bad enough. The father asked me, "What does this boy see in the street?" There's a loving family, and he does. Family that cares about him, and they do. What does he see in the street? Well, Baruch Hashem, that this boy had an open enough relationship with his parents to tell him what he was doing during those few days that he was not at home. Ate out Matzah Shabbos till about 4 or 5 in the morning, and then he didn't have a place to sleep, and he hadn't eaten since Shalosh Shudas that day. He had left the home on the Matzah Shabbos. Well, 5 girls who he met bought him supper from a 24-hour Milchiger restaurant in the neighborhood. They bought him supper, they ran out, and they got it for him. They found him a place to stay. He's king. is a little kid, 14 years old, 15 years old, and these girls, the mother instinct kicks in. A 14-year-old boy lost in the middle of the night with no food, no shelter. A cute little 14-year-old boy, like a little puppy dog, they take care of him. That's what it was, a little lost puppy dog in the middle of the night. He's sitting there, mind you, in his white shirt and his black pants. And he feels like king of the world. Wouldn't you? I mean, sometimes when I come home late at night, or when I stay in Brooklyn, rather than drive home at 4 o'clock in the morning or whenever, I don't have such an easy time finding a place to stay at 4 in the morning. I have to search, I have to look around. Where am I going to stay tonight? And this kid, without even snapping his fingers, his newfound friends run to his aid, find him shelter. They bought him supper. When's the last time somebody, a stranger, went out and bought you supper in the middle of the night? He feels like a king. He should go back to yeshiva now, where people ask him if he's going to marry a shiksa. When older brothers and sisters see a rebellious sibling, and 99% of the time it's the older ones that do this to the younger rebellious siblings, as opposed to younger siblings do it to the older rebellious ones, they'll pepper him or her, put in a dig over here, a sharp word over there, and that's poison. What we're trying to do is we're trying to make the kid feel at home among B'nai Torah, trying to make him feel comfortable among good people, trying to make him feel like $1 million because of his virtues, not $1 million because he's draying zacharum, he's running around in the street corners at 4 o'clock in the morning. If you want to know where a kid will end up, figure out what he feels proud of, what makes him feel like $1 million. If you know what makes a kid feel like $1 million, you tell me what makes a kid feel like $1 million, I'll tell you what's going to happen with that kid. When that changes, the kid's destiny will change. And brothers and sisters, very often they mean well. Maybe subconsciously there's some jealousy because this son is getting more attention than them. I don't know. But it's a very, very common problem in such cases. And if you sit down with them and explain to them what's happening, not only will you avoid disaster in the terms of a perception of imbalance and unfairness on the part of the siblings, you'll also prevent this type of disaster from happening. Short of throwing the problem child out of the house, how are you going to protect the others from the influence? How? What are they supposed to do? They're supposed to say, well, Al tischaber l'rasha, we won't have anything to do with him. That's not an option. Maybe they sleep in the same room, brothers. They eat at the same table. The way to do it is through understanding. Normally, the way to avoid negative influences is by staying far away. Distance is the device that we use to avoid being influenced. We use geography. We use space. We use walls that we build between us and the influence. But that's not an option over here. Over here, clarity and understanding has to be the tool that you use. The other siblings have to understand clearly what you're doing and why you're doing it. They have to understand. Without blame, without fault-finding, and without judging, because that's not necessary and even counterproductive in such cases. They have to know why you are treating this child the way you're treating him, what the plan is, what the objective is. They have to know also that you're not approving of the other siblings' actions. It's just a necessary step to improve an uncommon situation. Compare it in your mind and in your words to the siblings to a physically ill child. You have to wake up in the morning to go to school. They don't. They get more snacks and sweets than you do. They get lavished with attention because they are sick. And although among little kids, sometimes you find jealousy towards a sick sibling, but by teenagers, they understand. And it's that understanding that you need the siblings to have in order for them to be able to live smoothly and function comfortably in a home with their problem sibling. They have to perceive it as such, as not a common situation. You are kids going through a common life mode. This sibling is not going through a common life mode. He or she needs our help. We will be there to give him or her our help. Without this, a tremendous negative influence can be exerted by the problem child towards the other siblings. And if, chalila, that happens, disaster strikes, because the only justification for throwing a child out of a house, and this isn't an across-the-board justification. It doesn't justify all the cases. But where there is a justification, it's only going to be in a case where the sibling has a detrimental effect on the rest of the brothers and sisters, a detrimental effect on the house, where the child has the din of a roidif, somebody who's a danger to the others. Once that happens, then there is a possibility, again, not a certainty, there is a possibility that evicting the problem child from the home is the right thing to do. I say possibility because each case has to be judged individually. I cannot overstate that or overemphasize it. But just like the fireman, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan said this mashal. He said, just like when a fireman puts out a fire, the first thing he does is to spray water on the neighboring homes to make sure that the fire does not spread. And only when he's certain that the fire is contained does he focus his attention on putting out the fire. So too, our first priority is to make sure that where there is cholila, a problem, it is contained and everyone else is protected. When everybody else is protected, we are ready to focus our attentions on the problem and put out the fire. But what good is putting out a fire, spraying water on a fire that's spreading all over? By the time you finish putting out the fire here, you have another one over there, God forbid. And so it's of the utmost importance that in the case of a problem child, the rest of the family be sprayed with water. In this case, the water is an understanding, a clarity of exactly what's happening. That's the best way to do it. Now, you'd be surprised. Parents themselves can also be adversely influenced. This is a child who you love. And if you really have a good relationship with him, and you should, then you may have, even parents have a Yetzirah. And if you hear the same language constantly, you suddenly become less shocked by it. I heard from a Rosh Hashiva. It was a Talmud of Rabban Kotler. That he once went with Rabarin to a certain home of a balabas to collect money for the yeshiva. Rabarin walked into the man's living room and saw mounted on top of the fireplace a rifle. Rabarin was taken aback. "A bix, a gun," he said. "A gun!" And he left. Told this, then he was a bacha, this man, now he's a Rosh Hashiva. He told this man, "We have to leave." He was shocked at the sight of an instrument of murder. Now, you know, kids wear bullets around their neck. It shows you what type of, how far we are from the true perspective of things. But if you walk in, not once to somebody's house and see a gun mounted on the wall, but two or three or four or 10 or 20 times, it has an effect. A story with the Chafetz Chaim, who once wanted to move out of Radin to a big city called Riga. The city, I believe, it's on the shore of the Baltic Sea. Chafetz Chaim lasted 2 weeks. The 2 weeks he left, he said, "I have to run back to Radin because I saw Chilul Shabbos in Riga. Riga was a big city, and he was able to see Chilul Shabbos. And he couldn't tolerate seeing Chilul Shabbos. So they asked the Chafetz Chaim, fine, but what took you 2 weeks? First week you also saw Chilul Shabbos. And the Chafetz Chaim said, yeah, the first week I saw Chilul Shabbos, but I was appalled by it. I was shocked and taken aback by it. I shivered when I saw it. And the second week that also happened, but a little less. When I saw it happened a little less, I knew it was time to leave. We're talking about the Chafetz Chaim. What about a parent who has to live daily with one or many problem teenagers in his or her home? What is that parent getting used to? What is that parent becoming immune to? What did that parent once a time was shocked by, now not so much? Perhaps it even gets worse. Perhaps you even started not to laugh, but maybe a chuckle on the side of your mouth at his undesirable jokes. After a while, that sometimes happens. What are you going to do? Well, the first thing is that although it's important for all parents to maintain a close connection with a Rebbe or an Adam Gadol, parents of rebellious teenagers, it's a million times more important. I'm not talking about as a way to obtain advice and how to deal with the problem. I'm talking about a way to obtain advice about how to deal with yourself. You know, the psychologists, the mental health professionals, have something called supervision, which means the psychologist has like another psychologist that they report to. And one of the primary reasons for this is to make sure that the psychologist isn't getting affected by all the problems they deal with. Any parent of any rebellious or problem teenager must possess the same commodity. Must have somebody that they speak to about their own feelings towards the actions and the behaviors that are taking place in their house. Forget it, not because they need to deal with the child, but because they need to deal with themselves. And I found usually that it's best to have two separate people. One to consult regarding the problem, and a separate one that has nothing to do with you dealing with the problem, has to do with you dealing with you. Because these influences are very subtle and they come and you may not even notice them. You have to make sure that you have a good shower waiting for you that always works. Which means that you have to have one foot in the Torah environment. You have to say an extra piece of Tehillim every evening. Go to an extra shir. Make sure you, as an adult, get a constant supply of Torah inspiration and influence that could perhaps at least counterbalance what's happening in the other part of your life. I'm not talking now about dealing with the child, I'm talking about dealing with yourself. Worst case scenario, as I said, a very good person I know pushed over the edge by being in this industry. Over the edge. He's totally run amok. Now, he's become one of those people who I have to protect kids from. More commonly, there are more subtle influences. Never ever change the routine of your home in order to accommodate the problem child. Meaning, if the child doesn't like to sing Zmiris, that does not mean that the entire family should stop singing Zmiris because of this child. If this child has an aversion, people with very short haircuts and long payas, does not mean that you should change the grooming of your other children in order to make this one feel more comfortable. We have to try to influence the problem child and elevate him to our level, not for us to sink down to his. Now, temporarily, if someone's drowning in a sewer, you jump in. You get yourself dirty, but only if you can get out. I'm not talking about temporarily. There's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch that if a child is being captured by the Gentiles and there is no danger to his life, just to his soul, to his frumkeit, to his future as a religious Jew, you are machalal Shabbos on the spot in order to get him back, just as if his life would be in danger. Well, Shabbos is permitted to save somebody's soul. But Chilul Shabbos is not changing your lifestyle. It's not Bittul Shabbos, in the words of the Chazon Ish. There is a difference between being Mechallel Shabbos on a temporary basis as opposed to changing Shabbos totally. There is a heter that, of course, can only be used upon rabbinic consultation to do Chilul Shabbos and all of any of the Aveiros that are not Yehor Gvi'al Yavar in order to save somebody's neshama, where applicable. Again, like all halachas, can only be actually applied under rabbinic guidance. But to rip Shabbos out of your life, to rip Kashrus out of your life, that there is not justified. There you're talking about Roida. There you're talking about the problem child influencing and affecting everybody else's personality. They can't affect your personality. They can't affect your lifestyle. We discussed once before how to explain, how to articulate to a problem child this dichotomy of accepting him, not approving of what he's doing, of making an allowance for him, but drawing the line where it affects the entire house. It's a skill that parents have to learn. But on top of that, beyond that, parents also have to make sure, as much as possible, for their sake, they are not brought down personally, their own ruchnius, because of this kid. Don't forget, Hatzolus Nefoshes is a mitzvah. If you save Mechal Shabbos to save somebody's life, you are supposed to. That makes you go up in Madrega. It makes you more holy. You just did a great mitzvah. If it brings you down in Madrega, then it's time to reassess things to see if you're really doing the right thing. Guy that drives the Hatzolah ambulance on Shabbos gets a big mitzvah and goes to Gan Eden. He attains Kedusha, holiness, by driving on Shabbos, because it's a mitzvah. Once it becomes part of his personality, once Shabbos is no longer Shabbos by him, it's a different story. I want you to know that this mashal is meant literally, because I know that this is a topic of controversy among different Moirei Hoiro in different cities and neighborhoods, but there are many who hold prerequisites to a Hatzolah has to be enough people working there so that won't be one person driving around every Shabbos, because that's not a Shabbos anymore for him. He has to share it so that it'll be an occasional Chilul Shabbos as opposed to a career Chilul Shabbos. One is Chilul Shabbos, one is Bittul Shabbos. Now, of course, I'm oversimplifying things. Taking Dinei Nefoshes, life and death matters, and I'm condensing complex and serious halachic issues just as a mashal for us. The mashal, the lesson for us has to be that we have to make sure, for our own sake, if we want to help our children. I once told a parent who came to me about his child, parent was an alcoholic, parent was a semi-drug addict, or drug semi-addict, I'm not sure how you say it. And told him, Mr. So-and-so, the best thing I can do for your son is to straighten out his father. It's a big chesed to our children if we raise ourselves in Madrega, and we're not doing our children a favor if we let them schlep us down. And again, it's an issue with parents and it's an issue with siblings. As far as siblings are concerned, they have to be made clear to understand exactly what's happening in order to avoid jealousy, in order to avoid influence, and in order to avoid adverse behavior, counterproductive behavior, meaning counterproductive criticism and putting down of the siblings against the problem child. And the parents themselves have to be under some kind of personal supervision of a close friend, a rav, somebody who has the perspective and the perception to be able to recognize slight influences, and then they have to be dealt with as they come about. And now at this point we're going to take questions. Jin, what do you say to a sibling who complains, quote, it pays to do poorly in school, or it pays to do the wrong thing, since then when you improve a little, you get rewarded. He complains that it doesn't pay to be good. It's a very legitimate complaint. The answer is that we should not take for granted our non-problem children's progress. An A student should be rewarded for their progress, their effort. Obviously, it's the effort that we're rewarding, just as much as the D student. And you're right, it's especially important. And the Gemara says that you shouldn't treat your children differently in that, because look what happened by Yosef and his brothers when one brother got treated with favoritism. Gemara. So, if somebody does have a child who you need to lavish upon him more attention and more praise, and if explaining to the other children what's happening doesn't help, because that's what we're talking about, then you have to lavish equal praise and attention on the other children for their accomplishments. 100%. Now, don't forget, there are little children that say, well, you know, it pays to be sick because then you don't have to go to school. And among small children, this is relatively common. And we have to explain to the children it's not so. But among teenagers, you know, it's somewhat immature for them to say, well, you know, my 15-year-old brother's sick, so he can miss school for a few days, therefore it pays to be sick. That's an immature thing. It's below a teenager's level. And if you properly explain to the child, this rebelliousness is comparable, or rather, is analogous to a sickness, and you should be able to avoid him coming up with this complaint. However, if it's already ex post facto, if the complaint is there, this is the answer. You have to lavish the praise and attention on this child in order to even think that. It's like, let's say you have a recipe. You're making a recipe, and you put in a little too much salt. So now what do? You can't remove the salt. You have to put in a little more of everything else in order to even it out. For this little extra salt, everything else has to change. Same thing over here. You put a little extra praise over here and everybody else gets... You have to even it out. You have to add to all the other components. If that's what has to be done, then that's what has to be done. And halavai should be the worst thing that ever happened to a family, that everybody gets praised for their accomplishments, even the smooth, non-problem children. Punishment or setting limits for the problem child. Should you be strict and very firm about this misbehavior? Well, it depends, very simple, on a number of things. The purpose of punishment is a deterrent. Punishment is designed to deter the child from committing the act again. If that's going to happen, then of course punishment is a viable option. If it's not going to happen, if the child is going to just generate animosity, even if it's irrational, I mean, I know some students who, if they come late to class and you tell them you have to go to the principal and get a note, they become ballistic. what kind of business is this? Restrictions, rules, crazy place. There are kids like that, problem kids. School, you have to run that way. And sometimes a home, you need restrictions and setting limits in order to maintain the routine of the home. But that's not for the kid's sake, that's for the general sake of the home. But if we're talking about the sake of the kid, and this is his reaction, he doesn't respond well to punishments, then without educating him as to the necessity for punishment and for rules, it's not going to help. Remember, Sephorno says that the only way a parent has control over a child, if they disagree, is because the child feels that the parent has the child's good in mind. If the child's mind is somewhat twisted, such that he feels that the parent doesn't have the child's good in mind, then the punishment isn't going to work. It's not going to do any good. An education is more important than punishment. Again, if you need the thing of limits for the sake of the home, it's a different story. But if it's not going to work, we also had a story that we said here a number of times where there was a 15-year-old boy that brought a television into his home, and the family went to their local Rav, and the Rav went to Rav Palm. Rav Palm said, you can't force a teenager, you can't force him to do something he doesn't want to do, period. Period. There are certain times where you have to exert force in order to maintain the routine of the home, but you can't force a teenager to do something he doesn't want. It doesn't work. You just can't. And that's basically what the Sephorno says. So it depends on the response of the child. That's the answer to the question. Next, what if your child, a pre-teenager, has a somewhat difficult position because of a learning difficulty, which is being dealt with in chinuch, how to prevent the Weisgeworf syndrome of ejection from building dangerously? If I understand this question correctly, it's asking, if a child has a learning difficulty, how do we prevent the child from feeling inferior to everybody else? There are two possibilities. Possibility number one is to put the child in a school or a class with peers that are on an equal level. People compare themselves to their peers around them. If the child is in an academically challenging and superior school, he's going to feel much more inferior than if not. Now, this is not always the case. Sometimes this backfires. Sometimes the child will feel labeled for being put in a, they perceive to be an inferior class or an inferior school. And for their own self-esteem, they'd rather do worse academically in a better school than vice versa, and that depends on the child. Certain children feel better about themselves if they're doing very well, even if they're in what they call a loser school. Some children, on the other hand, feel better about themselves if they're in a winner school, even if they're getting quote-unquote loser grades. And I use the word loser and winner because that's the words the kids use. You have to figure out which one of those two will work, if any. Two, the second thing is that our society puts a tremendous amount of emphasis on academic performance. There are so many components and facets to a person that academic performance is not always what a person should be judged by. Valedictorian in school means, usually, the person with the best grades. Maybe we should change that. Maybe it means the person that put in the most effort. Maybe it means the person that did the most chesed. Maybe it means the person that came the furthest during their career in high school. There has to be a message given to the child that grades are not all that important. Maybe the child is very musical. Maybe the child is a good artist. Maybe the child has a wonderful personality. That has to be overemphasized a million times. Override our societal obsession with academic performance. Because that's really what it is. And the first way to do it is for us as parents to realize this obsession with academic performance. Now, it has its good points. Kinasoifrim tarbe chachma. It generates competition, which generates more work and better grades among the children. But for this child, that's not what's important. That's not the focus. For this child, what's important is everything else except academic progress. And it has to be emphasized a millionfold. Those are the ways to eliminate or prevent any inferior feelings in a weak learning child. Good night, everybody. Thank you for coming.